DJ Dang, but right now we continue with Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Good morning. President Trump is invoking a law last used to create Japanese internment camps to deport hundreds of people without court hearings. We talked to a lawyer suing to block the administration. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration also says it's investigating dozens of colleges, accusing them of anti-Semitism and race-based policies. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Schools say they are overwhelmed by what they call attacks on academic freedom. Also, can France use its nuclear weapons to deter Russian aggression against Europe? And how technology has upended the music industry over the last quarter century. It's Monday, March 17th. On this day in 1992, white South Africans overwhelmingly voted to end decades of apartheid. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Deadly storms killed at least 39 people over the weekend across the Midwest and South. Sudden dust storms in the plains killed motorists with hurricane-strength winds. NPR's Rylan Barton reports there was more volatile weather in the southeastern U.S.
In the east side, on Friday and Saturday, the system dropped baseball-sized hail in some places, produced dozens of deadly tornadoes. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves said that 6 people were killed in tornadoes there. Also, 12 people died in Missouri, where Governor Mike Cahoe said yesterday that hundreds of homes, schools, and businesses were destroyed or severely damaged. In Arkansas, the National Weather Service says that damage from 2 of the tornadoes there showed they were likely F4s. So that's the second strongest class of tornadoes, with one of them estimated to have a peak wind of 170 miles an hour.
NPR's Rylan Barton reporting. The Trump administration has deported more than 200 alleged criminals to El Salvador. That came after President Trump invoked a rarely used wartime law that's supposed to be used to stop another country from invading the U.S. A federal judge verbally ordered the Trump administration to stop the deportation flights, but the administration did not comply. NPR's Ada Peralta reports El Salvador has sent the people to prison.
The government of El Salvador released videos showing U.S. Border Patrol handing over dozens of men. Then the videos show the men in chains being escorted by armed guards. The videos show the men being shaved and then taken to El Salvador's maximum security prison. Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele said 238 of them were members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, and another 23 were Salvadoran gang members. The U.S., he said, would pay a, quote, very low fee to keep them in prison for a year. A spokeswoman for the presidency told NPR they did not yet know whether these detainees had been convicted in the United States. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Egyptian and Qatari mediators are trying to negotiate a new Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal to release more hostages in Gaza. But NPR's Daniel Estrin reports there are outstanding disputes.
Israel is demanding the immediate release of 11 out of the 24 living hostages still held in Gaza. The U.S. is calling for an exchange of hostages and Palestinian prisoners and an extension of the ceasefire for many weeks to try to reach a permanent end of the war. Hamas says it will release one living American-Israeli hostage, but is demanding immediate talks on permanently ending the war. Israel is not yet ready to commit to an end of the war, with Hamas still ruling Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants to fire his domestic intelligence chief because he has lost trust in him. The security chief has been a main proponent of a hostage release deal with Hamas. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Officials in North Macedonia are investigating a deadly nightclub fire that killed at least 59 people and left scores of others injured. Teenagers are among the dead. Initial reports suggest the club may have been overcrowded at twice its capacity and that performers may have used pyrotechnics as part of their show. 4 newly arrived astronauts are getting used to the International Space Station. They docked yesterday morning. They're part of a crew who will replace 2 NASA astronauts. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports that pair of astronauts has been on the station for 9 months, a lot longer than was planned.
Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore were only supposed to be in space around a week when they launched into orbit last June, but after issues with their Boeing Starliner spacecraft, NASA decided to keep them at the International Space Station, where they've remained for more than 9 months. Now they can go home.
Crew 10, welcome aboard the International Space Station.
The replacement crew arrived at the ISS early Sunday morning and were greeted with hugs and smiles by Williams, Wilmore, and the other astronauts aboard the space station. Williams, Wilmore, another NASA astronaut, and a Russian cosmonaut are set to begin their journey back to Earth as soon as Wednesday. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Former New York Democratic Congresswoman Nita Lowey has died at the age of 87. Her family says she died at home in Harrison, New York, of breast cancer. Lowey rose to chair one of the most powerful committees in the House, the Appropriations Committee. She was the first woman to do so. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
In the weeks and months to come, as public radio faces federal funding cuts, KEXC is doubling down on our coverage of what happens here in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. We're also working to be more transparent so you know exactly how we are funded. Here's Sarah Bignell, our CEO.
It's just a lot of unknowns, and I've been sitting in on tons of calls and meetings, and all of us had questions, but there's not a lot of answers to them. Sometimes it's hard to tune out the dread that exists. We can do what we can control, right? And so I think getting out the message of support now for us is really important, whether it's you can give us dollars or whether it's you can go and promote the good work that we're doing and spread the word of what we're doing to your friends, neighbors, coworkers, can go a long way as well.
KEXE.org. Read the stories about where you live and help us out. The people of northern Minnesota are our largest single source of funding.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll hear why a farmer in Peru is suing an energy company in Germany over climate change. But first,
the Trump administration has deported hundreds of people who it accuses of being Venezuelan gang members.
This weekend, they were flown not to Venezuela, but to El Salvador. In an extraordinary move, President Trump relied on a rarely used law from more than 200 years ago to quickly expel them without hearings or due process. A federal judge is trying to stop this.
We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido. So let's start off with what the Trump administration used to justify their actions.
Well, on Saturday, President Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act. It is a law from 1798 that authorizes summarily detaining or deporting citizens of an enemy nation. This is a wartime law. We are not at war with Venezuela, but in his order, Trump described Venezuela's Tren de Aragua prison gang as a force invading the U.S. And hours later, hundreds of immigrants his administration claims are in that gang had been deported to El Salvador. Here's White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt on Fox News.
The president invoked this authority to deport nearly 300 of them who are now in El Salvador, where they will be behind bars where they belong rather than roaming freely in American communities.
El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, said that he would lock them up for a year, and he released photos of shackled men being unloaded from planes and having their heads shaved.
Yeah, the ACLU sued to stop these deportations, and a federal judge agreed to temporarily block them, but what happened?
Yeah, it was an emergency suit from the ACLU on Saturday, and Judge James Boasberg of the Federal District Court in D.C. said that he didn't think the Alien Enemies Act authorized the immediate deportations. He told the government to turn back any planes that might already be in the air, but that didn't happen, and it's not clear if the planes had already landed in El Salvador or if officials chose not to divert them back to the U.S. El Salvador's president, who takes pride in flouting due process in his crime crackdowns, mocked the judge's order on social media, writing, "Oopsie, too late."
And tell us more about the concerns civil liberties advocates are raising over the president's use of this law.
Well, the Alien Enemies Act has only been used 3 times before, the last time during World War II when the government used it to detain Japanese, German, and Italian citizens. Lee Gallant, the ACLU's attorney in this lawsuit, told NPR Trump is misusing the law.
The Alien Enemies Act cannot be used during peacetime for regular immigration enforcement. Congress was very clear in the statute that it can only be used against a foreign government or foreign nation.
He says the ACLU acted fast because once the U.S. has turned someone over to a foreign government, federal courts lose jurisdiction. A judge can't order El Salvador to send people back.
Now, the people who were deported, who the Trump administration claims are gang members, do we really know if they are Tren de Aragua members?
We don't know who most of them are. The Trump administration hasn't named them, hasn't offered evidence to back up its claim. Since yesterday, some families of men who were in immigration detention in the U.S. have spoken out to say they fear their loved ones may have been in this group and that they are not gang members.
So what happens now?
Well, the Trump administration has appealed the judge's order temporarily blocking deportations under the law. The ACLU says it'll fight this vigorously. They insist there is huge danger in allowing the president to invoke wartime authorities during peacetime, that it sets a dangerous precedent.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wei.
Now we turn to one of the groups suing the Trump administration over these deportations. Skye Perryman is the president and CEO of Democracy Forward. It describes itself as a national legal organization promoting democracy through litigation. Good morning, Skye, and thanks for joining me in the studio.
And good morning.
So your organization filed the suit alongside the ACLU, and I'd like to just play you President Trump's explanation as to why he believes he can invoke this 18th century wartime law when there's no war.
Well, this is a time of war because Biden allowed millions of people, many of them criminals, many of them at the highest level. They emptied jails out. Other nations emptied their jails into the United States. That's an invasion.
So what's your reaction to that?
Well, this is really such a fundamental moment to have the president of the United States invoking this wartime authority mm-hmm. in a time where we are not at war. We are not being invaded. And the president has a number of tools at his disposal for immigration enforcement. But this is a really improper and a great acceleration of his attempt to accelerate power that he doesn't have under our Constitution. And it should really concern every single American, because this is an expansion of presidential power that could essentially say, I mean, these people have now been, removed, or the president is seeking to remove them without any type of due process, that's against our Constitution, but it's also a threat to everyone.
Now, you're saying he doesn't need to invoke this act in order to remove what they're saying are dangerous individuals?
Well, I think it's important because a lot of the administration sort of made for TV moments and talking points are not really, they're not really describing what's happening here. The mm-hmm. individuals, as we understand, that they are seeking right now to remove are already in custody in some way, but they're seeking to circumvent the process that we have in our country in order to just expand power and do something with no process at all. So that's highly concerning. We've not ever been in this situation in the country. But yes, obviously, the United States has comprehensive immigration laws with a lot of enforcement powers. But this one is a misuse.
Now, the administration carried out these deportations despite a judge's ruling blocking them. And they said the planes carrying the migrants were already in the air at the time of the ruling, so they didn't have to comply. What do you make of that explanation?
Well, I think, this is the government's positions here, and I heard you all summarize what the El Salvadoran president said, and then, of course, you have the Secretary of State retweeting that yesterday, making light of a court's order. This is not normal, and it's not okay. We filed a paper with the court late last night with the ACLU, of course, raising a number of responses to how the government has been conducting itself in the court hearing, and we are going to work very hard with the court to ensure that the government complies with the order. But we have serious concerns about this compliance because it does look like that they're just operating in the throes, that the rule of law does not apply to them. And it's highly concerning and should be concerning for all Americans.
Now, we've heard Trump advisors, administration officials blaming, in general, activist judges for blocking the president's
lawful authority, as they say. And this is, in this case, in other cases, even though these decisions have been made by Republican and Democratic appointed judges. In this case, did the judge overstep, as the White House officials say they did?
Absolutely not. I mean, you see the judge doing exactly what, you know, exactly what we want federal judges to do. In an emergent situation, he looked at the facts, he held a hearing, he heard the government, and he ultimately issued a temporary order. So while the case is pending, this is what it means to live under the rule of law in the country. It should be concerning to everyone that our president doesn't believe that the laws apply to him. And I'll just note that, you know, the majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans and the vast majority of actually Republicans, when they're asked, including last month, agree that presidents should follow court orders. And so we believe this is a real crisis point, and we're looking forward to raising these issues before the court.
Sky Perryman of Democracy Forward, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
A groundbreaking court case involving climate kicks off today in Germany. A Peruvian farmer is suing an energy giant in Germany for what he claims is its historic role in accelerating the effects of global warming and contributing to glaciers melting high above his home in the Andes, thousands of miles away. Here's Simeon Tegel reporting from Peru.
Peru is home to 70% of the world's tropical glaciers, but they are disappearing rapidly. Paucarcocha, a lake in the heart of the country's Cordillera Blanca mountain range, is already swollen by Andean meltwater to over 30 times its normal volume. The threat of flooding in the valley below, constant.
Hay mucho miedo porque no la laguna no está más alto.
The fear grows when it rains intensely, just like it has in recent weeks, and the lake rises, says farmer Saul Luciano Yuya. NPR managed to catch up with him in Hamburg.
En zona de riesgo ante un posible aluvión, no viven o estarían perjudicados 50,000 personas.
50,000 people living below Paucarcocha, around the town of Huaraz, stand to lose their homes and lives if the lake bursts its banks, Yuya says. Now Yuya is suing German power company RWE over the carbon produced by its coal-fired power stations, which have been belching it into the atmosphere since the 19th century.
We want Saul and the people in Huaraz to live in safety.
Francesco Mascher-Klein is a lawyer for the environmental nonprofit German Watch, which is supporting Yuya's claim. The landmark civil case, using a property law usually targeted at difficult neighbors, opened in Hamm, in northwestern Germany. Klein says that just by agreeing to hear Yuya's case, the judges have already set a precedent for dozens of other similar lawsuits being brought around the world, including one in Honolulu against Chevron, Exxon, and other oil majors.
No one should fear losing their home due to the climate crisis.
German Watch estimates that RWE has produced nearly 0.5% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. Klein again.
Fossil companies have known for decades their products caused climate change, but they covered up the science while they made hundreds of billions of profits.
RWE, which has never operated in Peru, denies legal responsibility. It argues climate change is a global issue caused by many contributors. If found liable, the company says, then even ordinary motorists could potentially be sued for their vehicle's carbon footprints. The climate crisis should be resolved by government policy, RWE says, not in court.
Espero que la desglaciación pare.
Yuya just hopes the glaciers stop melting, but he admits that's unlikely. Instead, he says the focus needs to be on making polluters pay to manage the risks. For NPR News, I'm Simeon Tegel in Lima, Peru.
This is NPR News.
19 minutes after 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up just after 6:30, it will be Minnesota Native News, and then we'll have Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special order pricing and more at drinkdragonfly.com. We also thank Lakeland PBS. Stay connected with Lakeland News, offering local news, weather, and sports available on demand on the PBS app. Slight chance of snow this morning, partly sunny, highs in the upper 30s to low 40s with breezy southeast winds. For tonight, slight chance for snow, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-20s, and tomorrow, slight chance of snow in the afternoon, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 30s to low 40s. Heartland Symphony presents a concert Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30 at the Gitche Zibe Center for the Arts in Brainerd. It will feature the world premiere of Ian T. Jones's film music, a piece inspired by the band Radiohead. And the Bemidji Senior Center has a program about dementia Wednesday, March 26th at 1 p.m. Learn how the disease affects people and how you can make a difference in the lives of those living with it. Thanks for listening to KAXC. We continue with Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are reporting on the first quarter of our century. Those 25 years show how our world has changed and give us clues to where we're going. In today's installment, we consider a quarter century of music. The world has changed even more than it did in the first quarter of the 20th century.
I mean, when you're down in the...
when music like this was popular. Jazz and blues spread through technology, flat disc records. Technology from the early 1900s eventually changed the music itself. New, more sensitive microphones made it possible for musicians to sing to their audiences in a more intimate way.
You came to me from out of nowhere.
Bing Crosby rode those innovations far into the century, while jazz and blues inspired music that lasted even longer.
Say my name, no one is around.
In our quarter century, technology again is changing music. In the year 2000, CDs ruled the earth. NSYNC sold 2.4 million copies of No Strings Attached during its first week, and that was a record.
But then piracy happened.
NPR Music's Ann Powers is our guide to this quarter century.
I mean, this was young tech masters figuring out how to share music across the new expanse of cyberspace.
In 2000, internet file sharing was already causing CDs to go.
Bye, 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 bye.
Napster launched about 9 months before that NSYNC album, and others followed. NPR talked with two University of Virginia students back in 2000.
I used to spend a lot of money on CDs and stuff, and now it's just... so much easier to just go on like these Napster things. It takes like 10 seconds per song.
I'm online right now, and there are 259,025 separate songs, all of which are online and accessible by me.
Which meant 259,025 separate songs for which artists and record companies were not being paid.
It was a real shock. I mean, the gates were falling everywhere, and fans were taking control.
Labels were freaking out. Entire record store chains went out of business.
This was as big a change as when the recorded music era began 100 years before. What most of us fans didn't know was what the labels were already planning, right? Which was to figure out a way to monetize and frankly corporatize this new Wild West.
First by suing Napster out of existence, and then by supporting music streaming. Spotify came out of Europe in 2006, reaching the U.S. in 2011.
Daniel Ek, the founder of Spotify, he's Swedish. Sweden was like the wildest Wild West for piracy.
Who knew?
Absolutely. And this was supposed to be like, hey, let's all put our stuff on the same platform, make it easy for fans. And as they were able to make these deals with the labels, they had the music everyone wanted.
For those who don't use it, Spotify is like a personalized radio. The record labels get paid, and you pick the music. Eventually, you pick different music because the tech makes it possible. I'm thinking about the way that I use my phone for music. I'll get a song in my head and I'll listen to it 50 times.
Right.
No problem. I may also go, an old song comes into my head, Snowbird.
Yes.
Spread your tiny wings and fly away.
And take the snow back with you wherever it came from on that day.
Anne Murray, right?
Yeah, well, at first I didn't know the name, but I found the song. I found that was the artist that had the hit. And then I start finding all the other versions of this song.
Right.
Elvis Presley sang that song.
The breeze along the river seems to say.
Loretta Lynn.
That he'll only break my heart again should I decide to stay.
I'll end up having this experience of music that I had no idea I was looking for until I started looking for it.
Well, this is why we love streaming, frankly. It feels so natural. It feels organic. It moves at the speed of thought. But there are consequences. There's been very major consequences for artists. The rise of streaming has really changed the economics of the music industry in ways that have not benefited most artists.
Well, let me understand that, because I would think that the person who's not super famous would benefit from streaming, because whatever their audience is, they can maximize it through streaming. If there's only 10,000 people in the world who might like their music, they can find it on streaming. Why isn't that not good for them?
Well, this is the paradox, right? We live in a time when it is far easier to become a, I guess, quote unquote, professional musician, or become a musician with the public, let's say, than ever before. But fewer and fewer people can sustain themselves.
Wow.
Because music has been devalued, frankly. If everything feels free, we expect things to be free. When the major labels negotiated deals with the platforms, the artist was left out in the cold.
And if technology made it hard to succeed, it also determined who did succeed. Algorithms and playlists increasingly choose music for people who stream it, and they often create hits.
So a song like Despacito or Old Town Road by Lil Nas X, which is a total streaming phenomenon, you know, it was on so many playlists that it just never went away.
Is it possible we're heading to that moment when people turn on a particular stream that's delivered to them by algorithm, and the algorithm begins sending them reasonably serviceable, good enough music that's produced by AI?
Yes.
And no human beings have been involved in it at all.
It's already happening.
You can't call me. This is a Vocaloid, a voice entirely AI generated. She's got a name, Hatsune Miku. You can see a picture of her rendered as an anime character, but she doesn't exist, singing without the singer. One of my kids listens.
People are so adaptable, just as no one thought at the dawn of the recording industry that, you know, listening to a voice that was pressed onto a slab of wax could be as good as hearing someone sing in person or play the piano in person. Look how we adapted to that. Bing Crosby got his mouth near a microphone and the world swooned. So this is what we do. We adapt to technology.
Ann Powers has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
We're telling the history of the first quarter of our century. We've so far heard of space travel and music, and we have more to come. This is NPR News.
Wouldn't it be nice if AI could actually do things for us?
Even just to do very basic things, like being able to make a sandwich or being able to clean a kitchen.
Some researchers are now putting AI into robots. Don't worry, they're not going to take over the world yet.
We can just throw some water on them, and in most cases, they don't work anyway, so.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on how researchers are applying AI to robotics on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on member-supported KAXE. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. Chris Walker will be joining me as my co-host in the 7 o'clock hour. And coming up at 9 o'clock, DJ Dang, your host for Headwaters. You can answer our question of the week. Tell us about a time luck was on your side. Happy St. Patrick's Day. You can text us 218-326-1234. Also coming up for Headwaters, DJ Dang wants to know your favorite things about Ireland, its people or its culture. He's going to read those texts as part of the request line this morning at 10:30. You can text us on either of those things, 218-326-1234. Temperatures throughout the area in the 20s right now. For today, slight chance of snow, mostly cloudy, highs 40 to 49, winds from the east 5 to 10. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 20 to 25, and mostly cloudy tomorrow with highs near 40, then lows tomorrow night in the mid-20s, and looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 30s and breezy north winds. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. Coming up in about 5 or 10 minutes, we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. And coming up at 7:45, it's another installment of What We're Reading, produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, we'll hear from Bemidji author Dennis E. Staples on his new novel, Passing Through a Prairie Country. We've received support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. Their February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Right now, it is time for Minnesota Native News.
This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, we hear about the 22nd annual Great Lakes Indigenous Farming Conference, plus important information for families about the Minnesota Department of Revenue's Child Tax Credit. First, let's hear from Deanna Standing Cloud.
According to the Ojibwe worldview, humans have an interconnectedness with the natural world around them, including all animals and plant life. This perspective is still upheld today and is the framework for the annual Indigenous Farming Conference presented by the White Earth Land Recovery Project. The conference is celebrating its 22nd year.
This is actually my fourth year attending, and I remember the first year I came, I was just blown away.
Kaylee Carnahan works for the Indigenous Environmental Network and is the lead organizer for their teaching garden located on their office grounds in Bemidji, Minnesota. Naturally attracting local pollinators, the garden serves as a healthy boost in the ecosystem and offers youth and community education on seed saving and Indigenous growing practices.
With the teaching garden, you know, we do a lot of food sovereignty work.
Presenters at the Great Lakes Indigenous Farming Conference persist that our land in Minnesota needs to be honored and protected. Leanna Goose, co-facilitator for the Rise and Repair Coalition, shares about her work and her kinship to the land.
In Indigenous culture, we really understand like our connection to the land is a big part of who we are.
The conference has been held for the past 3 years at the Sugar Lake Lodge in Cohasset, Minnesota, which offers a scenic view as participants learn from one another and networked. The conference included Indigenous vendors, cultural demonstrations, and community film viewings about building relationship to the land. For more information, visit welrp.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
Next, many tribal members might think they're not eligible for the child tax credit if they don't file taxes. The Minnesota Department of Revenue wants families to know that this isn't the case and that this resource is available to them. Emma Needham has more.
The April 15th filing deadline for federal and state taxes is fast approaching. The Minnesota Department of Revenue wants families, especially tribal members, to know about the child tax credit.
It can go a long ways in reducing child poverty in the state of Minnesota.
That's Paul Marquardt, the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
A family can qualify for up to $1,750 per child with no limit on the number of children. It is refundable credit, which means it can go past any tax liability you might have, and most will receive a refund.
To get the child tax credit, you need to file an income tax return. You don't have to owe taxes in order to get this money. And you can extend beyond April 15th without a penalty if you're getting a refund.
We recognize that many tribal members are not required to file an income tax return. And so we really encourage tribal members who would qualify for the child tax credit to consider filing a tax return to get this credit. Basically, all the filers have to do is file that income tax form, and you can receive that credit.
To get the maximum credit, the income requirements are about $37,000 total income for joint filers and about $31,000 for single income households.
If you have four children, you can qualify for some of the credit all the way up to almost $100,000.
Children up to age 17 qualify. The credit is also available for higher earner households, but at a reduced amount. This year, the Minnesota Department of Revenue is allowing filers to also receive half their child tax credit for the next year as well.
You can get payments, not just when you file your taxes and receive that refund, but later in the year, you can receive up to 50% of your credit in three equal installments.
Paul says filing electronically is often the easiest.
You can go to electronic filing on our website to do that. But also, you can find where there are some free tax preparation sites.
More information is at revenue.state.mn.us.
Last year, about $560 million went out to about 225,000 families and benefited about 450,000 children.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm Emma Needham.
Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It is the Monday morning show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Coming up at 8:45 this morning, we're going to meet Marina Lovell. She's the executive director of Great River Rescue in Bemidji, an animal rescue there. We'll hear about their upcoming Fur Bowl fundraiser this Sunday and also their Pet Fixers Clinic and much more. That's coming up before 9 o'clock. And then at 9 o'clock, it is Headwaters with DJ Dang. You can answer our question of the week. Tell us about a time luck was on your side. Text in 218-326-1234. And DJ Dang also wants to know, for Headwaters, your favorite things about Ireland. It's people, it's culture. Have you ever been there? You can read, he will read your text at 10:30. Again, text in 218-326-1234. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we thank Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, and saunas. Learn more online at hotspringhottubmn.com. Weather for today, slight chance of snow with mostly cloudy skies, highs in the 40s, east winds 5 to 10. For tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 20 to 25, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs near 40. Lows tomorrow night in the mid-20s, and looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 30s, breezy north winds. The City of Grand Rapids holds City Government Academy, a 9-week program that explores different aspects of the city, such as public works, community development, and more. The registration deadline is this Friday, March 21st. Find more info at cityofgrandrapidsmn.com. It's time to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
On Sunday, March 2nd, 1975, exactly 50 years ago, at Baker Woodlot on the Michigan State University campus, I beheld the very first bird I ever looked at through binoculars, figured out what species it was all by myself, and was instantly and forever transformed into a bird watcher with a life list. That morning was one of the most important in my life, so of course I had to mark the 50th anniversary by beholding that same bird, well, maybe one of its descendants, through my binoculars and now camera at the same place I saw that first one. So on February 28th, the day after I got home from Cuba, Russ and I embarked on my 2025 Chickadee pilgrimage. I wonder how many people would indulge their spouse in taking a 1,500-mile round-trip journey simply to see a species so common that we see it every single day in our own backyard. I started talking about making this trip several years ago, and Russ was game from the very start, never once wavering. March came in like a lion with a fierce north wind and temps barely above 20. As soon as we got out of our car on the morning of March 2nd, we could see small groups of robins passing over. The first major pulse of robin migration roughly follows the 37-degree isotherm, and apparently the warm weather a week ago sent a bunch of robins to East Lansing, who I suspect were regretting being part of the vanguard. We saw over 100 flying about in flocks or hunkering down, feathers fluffed, facing the fierce wind to keep their feathers from ruffling out. They did not seem to approve of paparazzi. I reminisced about all the birds I saw for the first time near the Natural Resources Building and the area between that and Baker Woodlot, though birds seem much harder to come by now. We saw our first two black-capped chickadees, the bird du jour, in a spruce tree right by the Natural Resources Building parking lot. That seemed auspicious, even though neither would pose for pictures. We weren't worried. We figured we'd quickly see more at Baker Woodlot. We walked the main path all the way around the woodlot. There were more oak trees than I remember. Oak leaves dominated the leaf litter, and I think there may be fewer mature beeches and cherries, though there were several huge downed cherry trees and many beech saplings. As I recall, there was plenty of snow on the ground on March 2, 1975. Now there was very little snow, but about half the trail was covered with ice. One big difference between me at 23 and me at 73 is that back then I did not need a walking stick to get around on slippery trails, but now I do. Age is a big part of it, of course, but so is the fact that I'm now lugging a heavy, expensive camera, making falling an even scarier prospect. Another critical difference between me then and now is that in 1975, I could hear virtually every bird vocalization in my neck of the woods, but didn't have a clue what birds were making those sounds. Now I can identify virtually every bird vocalization I hear, but can no longer hear many of them. Fortunately, chickadee songs and calls are still well within my hearing range. As we walked, Russ and I were both on red alert, intently looking and listening for chickadees, but we didn't find a single one within the woodlot, nor any other birds except a pair of white-breasted nuthatches who are apparently claiming a territory near the southeastern corner. I was happy about that. I didn't see my lifer at Baker Woodlot, but did regularly see them on subsequent visits. I was feeling pretty disappointed when we left the woods, but the moment we crossed Farm Lane, two chickadees who probably spent some of their time in the woodlot took pity, one even letting me take a couple of photos. As far as we could see, Baker Woodlot is 100% hardwood trees with very little understory, and chickadees really do like to spend some time in conifers, where cones supply excellent winter meals and thick branches provide some protection from the elements. They also appreciate an understory or weedy edges where they can find a wider variety of seeds. The chickadee who let me take a few photos was picking at seeds in the crusty area where snow had melted, very close to a stand of conifers. Russ and I returned to Baker Woodlot and walked the trails again later that morning and then the next morning before heading home. And both times, the nuthatch pear was very conspicuous, and both times, no matter how hard we looked and listened, we didn't see any other songbirds, woodpeckers, or anything else except Canada geese and a red-tailed hawk flying overhead well above the tree line. We saw and heard a chickadee on March 3rd at one of my other old haunts, the Red Cedar Woodlot, but that was the only other chickadee we saw that weekend, and we strolled all over campus, including along the Red Cedar River, me trying my hardest to find them. I wasn't aware or skilled enough 50 years ago to have an objective sense now of whether there really are fewer chickadees in East Lansing today, whether there are just as many but they gravitate to other areas, or what else might be happening. But I'm sure happy that I made it to Baker Woodlot on March 2nd, 2025, and that I saw black-capped chickadees on the golden anniversary of seeing my first one. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is 6:45. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up about 1 hour from now, it's What We're Reading with Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll hear from Bemidji author Dennis E. Staples on his new novel, Passing Through a Prairie Country. Great River Rescue has their annual Fur Bowl on Sunday from 1 to 3 at Bemidji Bowl. Individuals and teams may register at greatriverrescue.com. We'll hear more about that event and Great River Rescue in general with their executive director, Marina Lovell. That's coming up at 8:45. The Grand Rapids chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness has a webinar on gaming addiction this Thursday, 6 p.m. You can register at NAMIGrandRapidsMN.org. We're going to hear some music now. It is St. Patrick's Day. This is Minnesota band Boiled in Lead. That is Boiled in Lead. The song is called Jamie Across the Water. That is from their album that came out back in 1992 called Old Lead. It is the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. We've received support from Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.org. Temperatures in the mid to upper 20s throughout the region. For today, we can expect just a slight chance of snow with mostly cloudy skies. Highs in the 40s, cooler 40s in the Bemidji area, warmer 40s in the Brainerd area. Winds from the east, primarily from 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 20 to 25. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy as well. Highs near 40 with overnight lows tomorrow in the mid-20s. And for Wednesday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 30s. Breezy north winds. You can answer our question of the week. Tell us about a time luck was on your side. Text in 218-326-1234. KAXE, KBXE's annual Record Store Day sale will be Saturday, April 12th at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. We are accepting your gently loved vinyl donations through March 28th at our studios in either Grand Rapids or Bemidji during business hours. Thanks so much to everybody who joined us last Friday for Pi Day at both studios. We got a text over the weekend that said, I just wanted to thank KAXE for a phenomenal Pi social. I will dream about it forever. That sounds like very good dreams. Thanks so much to all who joined us there. It was a very good time. Coming up, we're going to continue now with news from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Egyptian and Qatari mediators are trying to negotiate a new Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal to release more hostages being held in Gaza. But the efforts are stuck at the same stumbling block that has stood in the way for a long time, how to reach a permanent end of the conflict. President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, was in the region last week trying to reach a breakthrough. He told CNN on Sunday that Hamas should take note of U.S. strikes Saturday on Houthi targets in Yemen.
What happened with the Houthis yesterday? What happened with our strike ought to inform as to where we stand with regard to terrorism and our tolerance level for terrorist actions. I would encourage Hamas to get much more sensible than how they have been.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv and has more on what's happening. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So help us understand the main sticking points right now that are complicating efforts to get Israel and Hamas to agree to reach a new ceasefire deal.
Well, you know, the sides have already completed phase one of their ceasefire, which was an exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. But that was only supposed to be an opening bid that would lead to phase two of the ceasefire deal, which would include moves to reach a permanent end of the war. Mm-hmm. But Israel does not want to end the war while Hamas is still ruling Gaza, and so it has refused to begin negotiating phase two of the deal. And instead, it wants a new deal. It wants more hostages released, and then it says it will talk about the rest. Hamas says, well, the hostages are its card to ensuring the permanent end of the war. So it says it won't keep giving up hostages without a commitment to end the war. And that's where things are stuck.
Okay, so how are mediators going to resolve these differences?
Well, our colleague NPR's Aya Betraoui in Dubai spoke with an Egyptian official who is close to the talks and who gave details about what mediators are trying to do to reach an agreement. And he said that this is the kind of deal they're trying to reach. That first Hamas would release Idan Alexander. He is a living Israeli-American hostage in Gaza. And that Hamas would also release the bodies of four American hostages as a starting point. That's something that the U.S. had been demanding in secret direct talks that they were holding with Hamas recently. And it's something Hamas has agreed to also. And then the mediators are hoping for a 50-day ceasefire extension. And by the end of that period, 11 living hostages, so that's about half of the living hostages still in Gaza, would be released, along with a group of bodies of dead hostages. And negotiations on a permanent end of the conflict would begin right away. They would also have to work out an Israeli troop withdrawal from the Gaza border with Egypt. That's something Israel has been publicly refusing. All these details are still in flux because the sides really still are stuck.
Okay, so we heard Steve Witkoff talk about the U.S. strikes on the Houthis in Yemen, and now there's this new development. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he will fire his domestic security chief. How did those factors play a role here?
Yeah, the Houthis in Yemen are backed by Iran. They have been supporting Hamas throughout the war. They've been disrupting international shipping routes and firing at Israel since the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict. The Houthis said that they responded to the U.S. strikes this weekend by targeting a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Red Sea. Now, U.S. officials have told Reuters that U.S. fighter jets shot down Houthi drones before they got close to the U.S. warship. It's unclear if Trump is going to press on with more U.S. strikes on Houthi targets in Yemen. But Steve Witkoff saying that Hamas should pay attention to this. We do know that Israel is preparing plans in case they say they need to return to war in Gaza. So that is a veiled threat to Hamas. And the strikes on the Houthis show that there is a wider regional dimension of this conflict, way beyond the borders of Gaza and Israel. And there's also this new political firestorm now in Israel that you mentioned. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to fire his Shin Bet domestic intelligence chief. He says he's lost trust in him. This was one of the main security chiefs who had been pushing for Israel to prioritize the release of hostages from Gaza, which is something that Netanyahu and his far-right coalition have been resistant to. This would be the third top security chief to leave his post in recent weeks, and the attempt to fire him will be major headlines in Israel for days to come and will distract from and even perhaps disrupt efforts to reach a new hostage release deal.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Daniel, for your reporting.
You're welcome, Leila.
Hey, Leila, got a dog?
No, scared of dogs. You?
No, they're scared of me. But we know of dogs in the NPR family who enjoy their screen time. One editor's dog, Rico, the Wonder Pup, was soothed by TV game shows.
So what do our canine companions see when they look at a TV screen? And can they get the same engagement from what entertains us?
Scientists in Wisconsin have been looking for those answers.
You know, I'm a massive geek about dog behavior. I have my own dog, and he becomes the sort of pilot project for all sorts of thinkings and ideas.
Freya Moat teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I'm a veterinary ophthalmologist by trade, so I do see clinical patients with eye problems, anything except humans.
Moat and her team surveyed more than 1,200 dog owners and found, maybe no big surprise, that dogs respond most to on-screen images of animals, especially other dogs.
And about a week ago, the New York Times reported that one movie in particular seems to fascinate our four-legged friends. Oh.
Now, that's from the Latvian film Flow, which won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. There's no dialogue in the movie. It follows the journey of a black cat, a capybara, a dog, a lemur, and a secretary bird as they try to survive a flood in a pretty barren world.
And a quick search online turns up viral videos of cats and dogs fixating on Flow. Ears perked up, eyes locked on screen. One of our Morning Edition producers says she streamed the film at home and had never seen her dog more focused on the TV. Scientist Freya Moat says it's an intriguing mix.
There are some natural sounds, there are some soothing musics, there's a lot of really beautiful colors that are used in the movie by the looks of things. So the cat is black and it's on this sort of colorful background. And if I think about how dogs see, you know, using their color vision, I think that exact contrast would be very visible to a dog.
And why is this work important?
People laugh when I say I do this research, but then it gets people thinking because it makes them realize that there's a lot more than just showing dogs TV. You know, it's actually the animal some people spend the most time with, you know, so I think it's really meaningful to people. It's also very gentle and enjoyable content. So I think we all need a bit more tonic for the soul right now.
I guess we're all trying to balance big news stories with gentle and enjoyable content. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
Roof. And I'm A. Martinez.
Oh my gosh.
It is 6:58. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday morning show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to have a special edition of the Up North Report. Chelsea Perkins tells us about Itasca County and Cass County sheriffs teaming up. They're going to be doing some things with ICE. We'll find out more about that. And coming up at 7:20, it is Events Up North, a closer look at the events happening throughout northern Minnesota this week. You can find a complete list of those at kaxe.org. Look for Events Up North. And coming up before 8 o'clock, Tammy Bobrowski with what we're reading today, a conversation with Bemidji area writer Dennis E. Staples. At 9 o'clock, it's Headwaters with DJ Dang. He's looking for your favorite things about Ireland and the country, its people. If maybe you've been there, you can tell us about it. Text in 218-326-1234. Also, our question of the week, tell us about a time luck was on your side. Again, text us 218-326-1234. Our weather for today, we do have a slight chance of some snow, mostly cloudy, highs in the 40s, east winds 5 to 10. And tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 20 to 25, and mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs near 40, with lows overnight tomorrow in the mid-20s. For Wednesday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 30s and breezy north winds. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us. You can become a member at KAXE.org. Northwoods Friends of the Arts in Cook presents entries from their annual photo contest, A Shot in the Dark, now through March 28th. Their gallery is open Thursday and Friday from 10 to 4.